Hey Osiris listeners, we want to tell you about our friends at Sunset Lake CBD who support this show. Sunset Lake CBD is a Vermont hemp farm crafting affordable CBD products designed to help with sleep and stress without breaking the bank. If you haven't tried CBD before, take it from me, it's a game changer. I use Sunset Lake's tincture every night before I go to bed, helping me get solid, restful sleep. And their gummies are great for daytime. Check out their new Good Vibes gummies, which have just a bit of hemp-derived THC to help you relax and unwind. Sunset Lake CBD crafts products with hemp grown on their family farm and ships them directly to customers. They have tinctures, salves, edibles, coffee, smokables, and even pet products. By the way, their CBD chocolate fudge is awesome. Check them out today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use coupon code TIME for 20% off all products. Sunset Lake CBD, farmer-owned, Vermont-grown.
Osiris.
What's up? It's Mike. Enjoying the podcast? Want more? Head on over to patreon.com/comesatimepod for a bonus episode each week. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Comes a Time. I'm Mike.
I'm O'Teal. We had a really good one today. Stefan Schwartz. I don't even know how to describe this guy. He worked for some very high-level government people and for the Navy, and also pioneered remote viewing experiments since the 60s. Worked with all the heavyweight remote viewers that were paid by the CIA for 20 years. And just the conversation is just amazing. He has this thing about non-local consciousness that he was explaining, and how it's basically just that consciousness precedes matter, and that all everything we see, time, space, sprung up out of consciousness and not vice versa. And the empirical scientific data to back that up. It's heavy.
He was really awesome to chat with and listen to, and it was super insightful. And it's a lot of the stuff that, like, you're kind of hearing it and then you go, oh yeah, makes complete sense. So I hope everybody enjoys it, and thank you for joining us for another great episode, and we'll catch you next time, everyone. See you later.
I want to get that correct. I have a not common name. So
O'Teal? No, I almost don't know that I know anybody named O'Teal. So where did it come from?
It's an ancient Egyptian name. So even Egyptians, like my across the street neighbor, don't recognize it sometimes because it's not Arabic, you know?
No.
But I like to get names right. Because
one of your parents was interested in Egypt?
Both, definitely. My parents were, like, you know, very much into Black history, and they had the most British. My dad's name was William Leslie Burbridge, just straight British all the way through. My mom was Carol Orville Smith. I guess she got a French middle name. But so they gave each kid one African name, except for my sister Leilani.
Well, that's very nice.
Yeah. So, I like to get people's names right, because I almost considered just changing my name to Oh What, because I tell people.
That deal is very interesting, actually.
That's an awesome name. It really is.
And I ended up studying quite a lot about ancient Egypt just because of music and the whole 12 system and all this stuff. And it really brings me to why I wanted to have you on as a guest, because I had a pretty powerful spiritual experience when I was 40 and was raised against religion, very much so, right? But then afterwards, I was told to, like, go check it out, but with an open heart, not trying to study it the way I'd done before, right? Totally mystical, not anything scientific at all, but I did it, and it changed my life. And I thought that a lot of what I learned was extremely logical, and I've been trying to develop this concept loosely over the last 10 years called spiritual logic. And then, you know, the algorithm on YouTube popped up Jeffrey Mishlov and this one conversation between you two that just was like, this is it. This guy is what I've been trying to say, but you know so much more of the history and have all the data. So thank you for coming on, because this is like the culmination of like maybe since 2010, right? Almost? No, longer than that. That's been a long time coming. So
good.
So you're the YouTube that I was looking at was called Non-Local Consciousness and Religion, I believe. Pretty long conversation. And can you get into what that means, like non-local consciousness?
Well, let's just start with that, non-local consciousness. There is an aspect of, let me say something even at the very beginning. I am a data person. All I care about is data. I'm not a theoretician and I'm not a philosopher. So everything I talk about and will talk about with you is based on experimental data. And what you see when you look at experimental data is that two things. One is that there is an aspect of consciousness which is not physiologically based. That is, the materialist view is dead brain, no consciousness. But the research in a variety of disciplines shows that there is an aspect of consciousness that is not physiologically based. That is, it's not brain-based. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it also makes it quite clear that there is a continuity of consciousness. That is, you have an aspect of consciousness that existed before you incarnated, obviously while you're alive, incarnated, but it continues after you die physically. And you look at the near-death research, you look at the reincarnation research, you look at the remote viewing research, you look at the therapeutic intention healing research, all of these things confirm this. The idea that this aspect of consciousness exists outside of space-time, and that space and time are limits, are informational enrichers, but they are not the parameters that we think of from a materialist point of view. And to sort of encapsulate that, let me quote Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. we're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Plunk, who didn't give a lot of interviews, was interviewed in 1931 by the Observer newspaper. And he was then, he and Einstein, as they said, were the two most famous scientists in the world. And the reporter asking, you know, you and Einstein are the most famous scientists we have. What have you learned? And I don't know what they thought he was going to say, something about atoms and molecules, probably. But what he said instead was, what I have learned is that consciousness is causal and fundamental. You cannot get behind consciousness. Space-time arises from consciousness, not consciousness from space-time.
Mm.
And Einstein, when asked a similar question, said, well, you have to understand that what people call reality is an optical delusion.
I love Einstein.
So what you have going on now is that in a variety of disciplines, the neurosciences, physics, psychology, parapsychology, anthropology, there is a growing recognition that consciousness needs to be integrated into science. It's not the dominant view yet, but it is the emerging view. And I think it's very important because it is also the only way we're going to get through climate change and preserve civilization as we understand it.
Now, can I interrupt you just for 1 second? Because I want to make sure we don't go past this. You said, and you're a data guy, and you mentioned a lot of research, empirical, like a near-death experience, past life, future. I'm sure any number of things that people would consider paranormal. Can you talk about where people can find this research? Because what you always hear from the strict materialists is that there is no research and it's all woo-woo. And you're just like, but then I know, like, just from being in the UFO stuff, which you could now you can finally admit, that like the CIA was paying remote viewers for a very long time, handsomely. Yeah. And so it's like, yeah, they say they're not researching. So can you talk about maybe some of these, sure, the near death and the past, yeah, life, sure, or whatever?
Well, first of all, go to Google Scholar, which is openly available to you, and search on these words. You search on remote viewing, search on reincarnation, search on near-death experiences, and thousands of papers will come up. Go to PubMed. That's PubMed, the National, yeah, Medical Library that the government maintains. Do a search on any of those subjects. Or search on the names of the researchers. And again, hundreds and hundreds of papers will come up. Go to Scopus if you have S-C-O-P-U-S, if you have access. And same thing, go to Science Direct. There are literally thousands of papers.
Wow.
I mean,
I'm writing all this down.
If you do a Google on the word meditation, you'll get something like 1,200 papers will come up.
Wow.
If you do a search on remote viewing, there'll be well over 1,000 papers will come up. I'm one of the people that created remote viewing. Remote viewing is a protocol, a technique. It is the only one that has gone from a laboratory protocol to an avocational interest. There are thousands of people that do it. It's got conferences and magazines and discussion lists. And, you know, it's a hobby like scuba diving or skydiving.
Some people get paid pretty well for it, like Robert McMonagall. I heard you need to cough up 10 grand just to get him.
Joe McMonagall. And
Joe, yeah.
Joe has been a remote viewer. He started in the SRI program. I would not do classified research because I felt that anything that we knew about consciousness ought to be made available to everybody.
I turned down
enormous amounts of funding because it was classified. Instead, I worked principally in creating remote viewing in using it to find archaeological sites like Cleopatra's Palace, Mark Antony's Timonium, the Lighthouse of Pharos, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, one of Christopher Columbus's caravels, the Brigliander. Yeah. I mean, again, all of this is published. It's all available. It's all meticulously documented. In fact, you can go to my personal website, stephanaschwartz.com, and you can see films. I made movies of it.
So just to be clear for the fans, so they understand, you found all these things using remote viewing, all these incredibly famous.
Yes, I not only found them all using remote viewing, but I ran a parallel search using electronic devices, side scan sonar, proton precession magnetometer, ground penetrating radar, to see if you could find them electronically, and you could not.
But the remote viewers could.
Yes, but the remote viewer and the remote viewers, what you learn with remote viewing is, first of all, there are no secrets. I think that's what scares governments, particularly Congress people, because if you're having an affair, remote viewers can find out about it.
Well, and a lot worse things than that. That's what I was wondering.
Yes, absolutely.
I always wondered, wouldn't the remote viewers have some kind of ethical conflict? You know, the CIA has done a lot of bad stuff, and they would have to know about it. You know, I don't know. I've always wondered if they, I think Ingo Swann mentioned something about like having to cut it off, you know?
Well, as I said, I wouldn't do classified research for just that reason. Yeah. But remote viewing is an ability. Everybody has access to this non-local aspect of consciousness. In fact, we can take religion, since you brought that up in the beginning. If you look at religion across all of human history and across all cultures, what you discover, if you put away the scriptures, the dogmas, and you just look at religion as a process that humans, no matter where they live, no matter when they live, no matter what culture in which they live, they get involved with and create religions. And if you look at religions, the main religions of the world today, what you discover is, first of all these religions start because a single individual has a non-local consciousness experience. Jesus goes into the desert to meditate, goes to John, who baptizes him.
Yes.
And then he goes into the desert to meditate, and he has a revelation and begins his teaching. The Buddha goes to an ashram and learns the technique of meditation and begins his teaching. Muhammad goes to the sacred cave of Hira. He has a non-local consciousness experience and begins his teaching. So it all begins with a single individual who has a non-local consciousness experience. And then you will note that they all learn the technique of meditation, and that becomes the basis from which they teach. Now, why meditation? And the answer is because meditation is the key to opening to non-local consciousness. Intention, the ability to attain and sustain intention-focused awareness, is the key to the whole business. That's why they teach meditation in martial art dojos in Japan, in Tibetan lamaseries in Tibet, in Hindu temples in India, and on in Catholic seminaries. Meditation teaches how to attain and sustain intentioned, focused awareness. Because most of what we think about and most of our consciousness is tied up with our sensorial impressions. It's too hot, it's too cold. Oh, I like that color, I don't like that color. It's too noisy, it's too quiet, whatever. Most of what we're doing, what we call consciousness, is processing sensory impressions. Remote viewing is a matter of, or opening to non-local consciousness is a matter of developing a technique, and there are a number of them, for allowing the sense impressions to retreat into the background and to allow this non-local part of consciousness to emerge. In religion, they call it the still small voice.
Yes.
So, okay, in religion, let's start with, we'll go back to that. First of all, you have the idea of the soul. Now, whether it's you have one god, multiple gods, goddesses, it doesn't matter. They, all these religions have this idea of this enduring aspect of consciousness. This is the continuity of consciousness, we would call it in science. But in any case, the idea that there is an aspect of consciousness that's outside of space-time, the soul. And then, again, let's stay with religion for a moment. Religions all pick a special place. There's always the place, whether it's a temple or a synagogue or a church or an Etruscan sacred oak grove or whatever. There's the special place. Now, why is there a special place? I mean, why do people gather for religious ceremonies? Why don't they just do it at home? And the answer is, and we know this from the neurosciences, is that when people join together, and they've shown, particularly a researcher named Andrew Newberg, who's a neuroscientist, neurologist, he hooked people up to EEGs to monitor their brain waves. And what he discovered was that when people join together in a common intention, and you'll notice that when you go into begin a religious service, there's a statement of intention. You know, it's the Nicene Creed if you're a Christian. It's a statement of the belief in voodoo gods if you're a voodoo practitioner. Whatever. When you get past the cultural details of it, the dogmas and all that, the rituals, what you find is these commonalities that occur again and again in all the religions. So you go to a special place at a special time. And we also know that this special place business is important because in remote viewing research, what we've discovered is that it is easier for a remote viewer to see Chartres Cathedral, for instance, than a French warehouse of the same size. Now, why is that? And the answer is because Chartres Cathedral has been the focus of intentioned awareness in a highly emotional state for hundreds of years, whereas people drive by warehouses, they don't pay any attention to them. So you've got, okay, I'm going to have to stop. I'll get rid of it, but I got to do it.
Sorry. It's totally fine.
Wait a minute. Oh, okay. My wife got it. Anyway, so picking up. You go to a special place because the act of doing that, of focusing on that special place, informationally enriches that. It becomes... The word that proper word is it becomes more numinous. Carl Jung coined the basic understanding we have of numinosity. He said, "Numina," by which he meant information, are psychic entias. They are outside of space time, and these acts of intentioned observation make places sacred. That's how they become sacred, is that many people in a highly emotional state focus their attention very singularly on that location. So you gather at a certain time, at a certain place, in a special place, and you join together, and then there is some singing, dancing, chanting. Why? Because as Newberg found, when people get together and they sing together, chant together, dance together, drum together, depending on which religion it is, what happens is all the brains synchronize. And so the intention is magnified by the fact that all of these brains of the people involved all synchronize and they all are moving in the same way. And that prepares people. So at some point in the service, there is a period where some, not all, and not always, of the people have a non-local conscious experience, which is witnessed by the others in the community, which confirms the reality of their religion. You know, if you're a Christian, you're speaking in tongues, you're prophesying. If you're a voodoo practitioner, you're speaking as one of the gods. If you, there's also a period of healing where we hold people in healing, in prayer together, because again, there's a linkage of intention to consciousness. And then at the end of the service, there is a restatement of intention and commitment and a reassignment of gathering together again. So if you look at religions, what you see is that these same sort of empirically developed understandings developed across all the cultures and at all times, that if you do these certain things, the joining together, the special place, the chanting, the drumming, the letting some but not all of the community have a public non-local consciousness experience. And then it gets down even finer. We've done research which, for instance, shows that just looking at words and how they're written makes a difference. It makes them sacred. Why do totems or relics become sacred? And the answer is because people focus intentioned awareness on them. Mm-hmm. And again, you go back to Planck, consciousness is causal and fundamental. Mm-hmm. And so acts of consciousness literally change reality.
You know, it's something I saw earlier, maybe it was last night, that speaks to exactly this, because I think it was Jeffrey Mishlove. He had on a guy named John B. Alexander, who I gather was a military guy.
Yes, I know John well. He was a colonel in the army.
Well, he took his wife to Brazil, and they did, I forget which branch of the African. You know, I know there's Candomblé and Vodun and all this different stuff. Off the top of my head, I don't remember, but it's what we would call a voodoo ceremony. But it was a specific branch. And he said, you know, he had contacts with, pretty high contacts with government people there. He was there as about 300 or 400 bazillions and only about maybe 8 or 10 white people. His wife went up to... there was some sort of invitation offered, and I assume she needed some healing of something of some sort. And when she touched this thing, something jumped into her. She was writhing around on the floor and going bananas. Now, I don't think she was a practicer of this religion.
No, almost, but she certainly was part not. Of a community of people who were all focused at that moment.
And it happened.
That experience.
And she didn't even remember it. She did not even remember it. And so John Alexander's like, I can tell you, that's not my wife. Like, she doesn't usually do that, you know. Everybody else thought it was perfectly normal.
Yes.
But, you know, she was like, and the fact that she didn't remember it, so you didn't even have to be a believer going into it to, like, you know, for it to happen to you.
Yeah.
He said, basically... where it's all semantics, but he was like, she was possessed at what we would call being possessed.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, that, as I said, that's an example of exactly what I'm talking about. You go to the special place at the special time. You have the special ceremony, whatever it is. And there's that period of dancing, chanting, drumming, whatever. And then some, not all, and not always, of the people there have this non-local consciousness experience. And as I say, you could go to evangelical churches and listen to people speaking in tongues or prophesying. You could go to another kind of service and they hold people in healing and, you know, laying on of hands, that sort of thing. All of these same elements, these same things that I'm describing, the special place, the special time, the special ceremony, the linking of intention consciousness, the period of dancing, drumming, chanting, the time when some but not all of the community has this experience. But then, as I was saying, we have also known, again, for based again on scientific research, we know that literally the shape of the letters that are the focus of this intentioned consciousness gives them a numinosity. So what I wanted to say was, what all of this is telling us is that we are dealing with an information phenomenon, that the act of intention consciousness creates in the non-local domain what I would call information architectures. That is, people hold common interests. Now, we also know, by the way, that whenever 10% of a cohort, whether it's a church group or a nation, change in consciousness, the whole cohort has to accommodate to that. Research that was done at Van Rensselaer Polytech showed that when 10% of a cohort, and let me give you some examples of how that plays out. If you do a Google keeps track of the words people search on, and you can find them out. If you look about 5, maybe almost 6 years ago, there was an enormous shift from gay to LGBT and then LGBTQ. Now, why did that happen? The president didn't go on television and say, we're now going to stop saying gay and we're going to start saying LGBT. When did the word Negro disappear and the word Black appeared? Why? Did some major figure stand up and say, we're going to do this? No. What happens is individuals change their consciousness. And when enough of them do that, then the consciousness of the whole culture changes, because culture is the creation of individual consciousness. I'll give you another example. When I was a boy and you went to somebody's house, there was an ashtray in the coffee table in the living room and a pack of cigarettes and one of those lighters your mother told you not to fool with. And so everybody had that. You don't see that anymore. Why is that? Did someone pass a law that you couldn't do it? No. It was because the consciousness of the culture changed as a result of individuals making a new choice.
You kind of see that now where it's phones. I imagine if someone was to take a percentage of the time that the phone is actually used to speak to someone else versus texting with someone else. And now it's texting isn't even, now it's like you can hit a button to thumbs up a thing instead of, so it's like the actual course of conversation is changing too. And it's the no one said, changed. Hey, by the way, we're not calling anymore. We're just texting. So it's very interesting that
talking in emojis.
What I'm trying to say is that consciousness is, as Planck said, causal and fundamental. And when you understand that, then you realize that to change things, you need to change individuals' consciousness. And when you do that, or individuals choose to change their consciousness, then the entire culture changes to accommodate that.
Mm. And so that's why the authoritarian governments always go after the artists and the poets first, exactly. And the philosophers, because they exactly. know it might get out of hand.
Yes, exactly.
Could I
that's
ask you
why they try to get control of the dispersion yeah. of information, mm. or increasingly misinformation or disinformation?
Yes.
You can manipulate a culture by getting a large number of people to believe something.
Well, yeah, absolutely. We've seen that. I have a question yeah. for you about the actual act of the remote viewing and the preparation leading up to it. Like, for instance, we were talking about how, you know, you have a ceremony or you have a ritual. Was there a certain, like, could you walk us through what it was like for, let's say, the 2050 experiment, the remote viewers? If I'm one, I show up day one. What is it? What is the process like? Do we go through a group meditation together? Do you say, I want you to focus on 2050 wherever you are? Like, what's the process for those viewers?
Well, it's pretty straightforward, actually, quite simple. I encourage people that there are a number of ways of doing it. Let me stress again, remote viewing is a technique. It's a protocol. We created it back in the early 70s. I started in 68. Russ Targ and Hal Puthoff, Ed May, they started in about 70, 72. The three big labs that did this were SRI, Mobius, my lab, and Princeton University. The Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Group, and other people, but those were the three big labs that literally created remote viewing as a technique. Mm-hmm. So there are several techniques. There are people that commercialize it and say, well, this is the technique, or this is the special secret technique, but it's not true. That's commercialization.
Yeah. Okay.
So in order to do this, what you need to do is to get to a relaxed state. So if you and I were going to do a remote viewing, Mike, or OTL, you would come in, or we would sit down, or we just do it on Zoom. I do it all the time.
Yeah.
And we'd sit in meditation for a few minutes just to calm ourselves, to allow all the sense impression data to retreat into the background. And then I would say to you, okay, I want you to go forward in time to, I'm going to show you a target as an example. Or I would like you to locate, the buried building or whatever, but let's just say a target. So I'm going to show you a picture in an hour. And an image is coming into your mind now that when you see the picture, you will know that you have had a hit. So could you make me a little drawing of that picture that comes into your mind? Could you describe it for me? And then I would ask you a series of questions and you draw or write. Now, the interesting thing is, at the time that you're doing this, there is no picture. It doesn't exist yet as a target. Only after I get your data, you either send it to me or you take a picture with your smartphone and send me the data if we're doing a Zoom or whatever,
yeah,
a Skype. Only after I get your data, but before I look at it, I go to my random number generator, randomnumber.org, and a random.org, and I get it. Let's say I have 100 targets. So first of all, that's a pool of targets. That's all the possible futures there could be in these targets. So I ask it to pick two numbers, whatever, let's say 8 and 34. And then I show that to the judge, the two targets, or five targets, or seven targets. That depends on what kind of statistics you're trying to do. And I give the judge five targets or two targets, seven targets, whatever. And I say, would you look at this? Mike and O'Teal have each done a remote viewing independently of the target. And would you please compare their data? Is it most like target one, target two, target three, or whatever many targets there are? And after the judge has made his judgment, then I go back to random.org and I say, of the numbers that you originally picked, pick the one that becomes the target. So the only way that you can do this successfully is you have to go into the future.
Yeah.
Because at the time that you're doing it, there is no target that has been designated.
Yeah.
So this is what we call in science pure triple blind. I don't know the answer. You don't know the answer. In fact, no one on earth knows the answer because the answer hasn't been created yet.
Oh, I like it. I want to try.
What we learned from this is that it is as easy for a person to describe something that's going to be selected in the future in an hour as it is to describe something that happened 2,000 years ago. I mean, when I do the archaeological work, what I would do is I would get a map of the area I wanted to search, and I would reduce it to a blueprint so that all the colors were removed. So it's just this sort of bluish grayish and the white.
Yeah.
And I would take all the names off of the target so that it's just basically some lines. I wouldn't tell you where it was, and I would say to you, each, if I was interviewing you each independently, I would say, Mike or O'Teal, I want you to go over this map. And my first question is Cleopatra's palace to be found within the confines of this map? And you'd go over it and you'd say, yes. And I would say, well, then would you make as small a little circle as possible as to the exact location? And then I would say to you, okay, you've now located it. Now, would you please describe for me what I will find when I go there? And we know from the research that people can describe things down to 5/8 of an inch. They're tiny, as small as you like.
That's so cool.
So then I would say to you, okay, would you describe for me what I'm going to find there? And if you said, well, it's buried under the ground, I would say, well, yes, how deep will I have to dig? Now, it's hard to get non-local consciousness doesn't work very well with analytical terms. So I would, if I were doing it as an experiment, I would say to you, you're standing on top of the thing you are describing. Where does your head come in terms of the surface of the earth? Does it come up to your waist, up to your shoulders, up to your chest? When that was over, I would then measure you, and that would give me the depth. Because if I said, how many feet down is it? That's harder for remote viewers.
Right. Yeah. That's too earth.
Right?
Yeah. That's too.
You're working visually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I would say, what color is this? Or, to give you an example, and you can go to, for instance, stephanieschwartz.com, and I make films of these too. So, but before we get to that part, I would also then, once I had your data and I had the location, and what I'm looking for is I have like 5 to 7 viewers. I'm looking for what we call consensus zones. Did you and O'Teal pick the same place?
Hmm.
Maybe you picked 3 or 4 places to locate something, but you all picked, or most of you picked, the same place. That's the consensus zone. So then I would have a separate expert who was a specialist in that search that area electronically to see if he or she could find the thing that you were describing. And to give you an actual example, which you can see, I was working in Egypt And I wanted to dive in the Eastern Harbor because that's where I thought Cleopatra's palace was and Mark Antony's palace. And the University of Alexandria went to the governor and said, you know, this is all nonsense. It can't possibly be real. And so they agreed. The governor of Alexandria said to me, would you be willing to do a test which they control? I said, sure. So they said to me, the university, can you locate a particular building in a buried city about 40 kilometers from here where we have begun to do archaeological excavation? And so unbeknownst to me, they had already had it surveyed by ground penetrating radar by the University of Delft. And so I had two remote viewers, Hella Hammett and George McMullen. I took them out into the desert and I said to them, okay, I want you to locate this building. And the Egyptian archaeologist, a guy named Fakharani, knelt down and he drew a little picture and he said, what I want you to find is a building that has more than one room and that has a tile floor, a mosaic tile floor. And so we're searching an area of about 1,700 square kilometers.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's about 114 degrees out in the desert.
Yeah.
And after about 3 hours of walking around, George says, okay, I know where I want to go. So he said, we're getting back in the car. We can't walk to it. We'll have to drive to it. So we get in the car and the Egyptian archaeologists are all going snicker, snicker, snicker. And we go out and George says, stop here. We get out of the car, snicker, 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 because of course I don't know this yet, but they have already had it surveyed and there's nothing there, they say. And George is walking along. You can see it in the movie. And George says, okay, I'm walking over this building. It has three rooms. I say to him, George, could you stake out the corners for me? Corners are, of course, very important. Oh, yes, I can do that. And he describes the building as being Byzantine, not Roman. Hmm. Snicker, snicker, snicker. All the buildings they think are Roman. And he says, it's about 3 feet down. And he sort of looks at his legs and says, you know, it's about up to my knee. And this is a building that was Christian, not Roman, snicker, 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 and goes on. And then he goes away and I bring Hella in and I ask her to do the same thing, locates the same place. She sits down. She says, well, there's three rooms. We're sitting on the sand in the desert. Underneath me, it's about 3 feet, 4 feet. There are three rooms. And, oh, there's this weird column that's in the middle of the second room. And something about it got very hot, but it was not built by the people that built the building. It came later. Snicker, snicker, snicker. So anyway, they do that. We bring George back. I say, George, now can you stake? You said you could stake it out. Could you stake it out for me? So he puts stakes in the ground, and that's where we're going to dig. And Fakharani, the Egyptian archaeologist, says to me, the University of Delft surveyed this area. There's nothing there. I said, I don't care. That's where we're going to dig. So we dig at 3 feet, a little over 3 feet and a few inches. The building begins to emerge. That's not supposed to be there, but there it is. It has three rooms. In the middle of the second room, there is this weird column, which turns out to have been a kind of oven that was built hundreds of years later after the city had been abandoned and the Bedouins had built this oven. And they used it to cook bread. And when we get down to the bottom, George has drawn a picture of these little tiles. He says they're red, black, and white. They're smooth on one side, and they have white plaster on the bottom. And they're about 5/8 of an inch. And they were, most of them were taken away, but you'll still find enough that you can prove there was a mosaic floor there. And then we get down, and there they are. And then we go a little bit deeper to the foundations, and you can see the Christian consecration marks. It's a Byzantine structure, not a Roman structure.
Hey there, Osiris listeners. I wanted to tell you about our friends over at Smart Wool. For more than 25 years, Smart Wool has been making merino wool socks and apparel designed to keep you comfortable. Because they want to help you play, laugh, and explore in the outdoors with every thread they knit and every step you take. Because they believe that comfort sharpens focus and lets you perform beyond your limits. They are here to help you feel good. Now, it's up to you how far you will go. Take 15% off of your first order at smartwool.com. Smart Wool. Go far, feel good.
What's up, everyone? I'm Mike.
And I'm Oteil.
And these are our Sunset Lake CBD gummies that are almost gone. Sunset Lake CBD is a farmer-owned business that ships CBD products directly from their farm to your door.
For years, Sunset Lake was a Vermont dairy farm producing milk for Ben & Jerry's ice cream. In 2018, they diversified and started growing hemp for CBD.
And with a product for everyone, they offer pre-rolls, hemp cigars, and hemp flowers, as well as tinctures, gummies, and CBD-crafted coffee to help with stress, aches, and pains.
Sunset Lake CBD saves you money by shipping high-quality CBD products directly from their farm to your door.
Want to know what I've been using a lot of, Oteil? This salve with the arnica on my old bones. You get back from a show and you got tore ankle, rub a little bit of this on there. You're ready to dance the next day. And you know, Sunset Lake, comes a time listeners can visit sunsetlakecbd.com and use promo code TIME for 20% off of their purchase. That's sunsetlakecbd.com, promo code TIME, and tell them we sent you.
Bam, 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 bam.
And then you went running right back. Yes, then you went running right back to the river and dove in and said, "We're on."
And yeah. Found Cleopatra. Hella Hammett. I've heard about her. She is no
joke. Wow, that's phenomenal. That's Hella Hammett, really. Does someone know, like, you know, in talking about it, you kind of said that, like, if Oteil and I were to do it, I have to be honest, I'd love to try. But is there a way to know whether or not, like, do some folks have it, some don't? Is it people who meditate
and have more experience
in transcendence? Like, you know, from your perspective, I mean, you know, from the beginning.
We know from the research that about 11% of people are particularly good at it. Almost everybody can do it to some degree, but it's like any other human skill. You know, it's a bell curve. There's a few people at one end who are really, really good at it. The Hellas, the Georges, Joe McMonigal.
Ingo.
There are a few people at the other end who just don't seem to be able to get it. They tend to be highly analytical people who just don't have much imagination.
Yeah, that's it.
But most people fall in the middle, somewhere in the middle. So, my guess would be, I don't mean to have to do it, I'd have to do the experiments with you, but that you could do it. As I say, most people can get at least some information non-locally. Meditators do better than non-meditators. Again, why? Because meditation teaches the ability to attain and sustain intention-focused awareness.
Right. I try to spend as much time in that space as possible. I do float tanks. I do meditate twice a day. Anything I can to spend as much time away from Earth as possible. So I believe that there's, sometimes you're kind of like, Oteil, you may have said it earlier that, like, sometimes people do experience some of these things, but they're not attuned to it. So it blows right by them.
Or even taught to ignore it or discount it. Like what Jeffrey Mishlove was saying about, it's immaterial. It's nonsense. And it's like, so people, I dream into the future. but I learned to lucid dream from a Carlos Castaneda book. So I remember my dreams. I think all these people that have deja vus are dreaming into the future, but they don't remember their dreams. Mm-hmm. But I do. So when the deja vu feeling happens, I look around at things that I picked out that are unusual in this minor, completely banal moment. So I need to pick something out, you know, even people that I haven't met yet, routinely. And I'm like, I always tell people, I feel like I know you already. But you know, what? this guy that that Mish Love interviewed, Lynn Buchanan, he said something so cool. He said, your nerves, our nervous system, are strands that carry electrical energy. That's basically an antenna. And he said, our whole body is an antenna. And the ninjas have a name for it, Sake Ninjutsu. And so he thinks that this antenna is how you feel like if someone were to blindfold you and take you into Auschwitz, you would be like, hey, man, I'm getting a dark feeling here, because your antenna could pick it up, you know?
Well, you have to be, I would qualify that. First of all, we know that non-local consciousness is not electromagnetic in nature.
Yeah.
And we know that because I did an experiment back in the 70s in which I got people to locate an unknown wreck on the sea floor. And then I put people in the submarine and asked them to describe where other people were hiding in Northern California. Now, the important thing here is in the early 1970s, the general feeling was that there were signals, senders, receivers, and that non-local consciousness was probably what's called ELF, extreme low frequency electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah.
And papers were written about that. Michael Persinger wrote a big paper arguing it was ELF. At the time, I was the special assistant to the chief of naval operations. And so I had been briefed that the Navy was doing a project called ELF, or then Project Sanguine, because they wanted to use ELF to communicate with the missile submarines without having them come to the surface. And so how do you do that? See, if they came close to the surface, the Soviet satellites would pick up the heat from the nuclear reactors. And so they wanted the submarines to stay deeply submerged. But the question was, how deep will electromagnetic radiation penetrate into seawater? And what they discovered, they got a very specific depth. And they also discovered that the only thing it could possibly be was ELF radiation, because everything else was filtered out by the seawater. And so I wanted to do a submarine experiment. I read this Russian work that was done by a man named Leonid Vasilyev, and he was a very good researcher and had published in some secret thing. I don't know how the CIA got hold of it, but anyway, a friend of mine was the head of the CIA, and he sent me these papers that were translated. I don't know how he got them, but and which Vasilyev was trying to answer the question, is this electromagnetic? And he put people down into caves and down into mine shafts. They put them into Faraday cages, which shield electromagnetic radiation. And he finally published in his papers, it had to be ELF if it was electromagnetic. So, and then again, there was the Persinger's question. And so the only way to really answer the question would be to put a person in a situation where they were shielded from ELF. And the only way to do that was put them in a submarine. And I went to Hyman Rickover, who's the father of the American Nuclear Navy, and I asked him if he would let me do this experiment. And he said, no, he didn't want to do it, because the media would make a big fuss about it, and there'd be a lot of discussion about the secret missile submarines, and the Navy wasn't interested in that conversation. So he wouldn't do it, and I didn't think it would ever get done, because Vasilyev tried to do it in Russia, and for whatever reason, he couldn't do it either. But then I went out to California to take a fellowship, and two friends of mine had retired from the Navy and taken over the Institute of Marine and Coastal Studies, a at University of Southern California, and they offered me a submarine.
Nice.
And therefore, I was able to do this experiment and demonstrated that it was not ELF, it was not electromagnetic. So it's not like it's your the nervous system is not an antenna, like a radio antenna. That would not be correct. We know, for instance, that it is possible to describe things that were buried for thousands of years that nobody knows about. They may know they exist, but they don't. Everybody agrees they don't know where they are. And you can't explain that electromagnetically. The brain is only capable of generating enough power to light a little tiny LED bulb.
Yeah, it's like a 5 watt we generate or something like that.
Yeah, maybe a little less. Yes.
Yeah.
But so you couldn't send, you don't have enough electric power to send out a signal. So this whole idea that that people had that what was going on in non-local consciousness phenomena was some sort of electromagnetic phenomenon is just not correct. I mean, people still say it. They still talk about senders and receivers and I'm sending a signal and blah, 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 blah. But that's not what's going on. I mean, we know that, again, from the research. What seems to be going on is much more like a Google search. You know, you hold the intention to locate something. That's like doing a Google search. You know, you put in the search terms and Google goes and searches all of the millions and millions of sites and everything and comes back and gives you a couple of places to look. In the same way, when I do a remote viewing experiment and I ask you to locate something, that intention that we share together, and we are linked, by the way, both the researchers and the remote viewers are players in the success.
In the intention. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody's a player in the intention contract. So I ask you to do this location. Well, that's like giving you a search term for a Google search, only you're the Google search technique.
It sounds like the Akashic Records that I hear of, and we're the internet somehow, we have access to this non-local pool of info.
Yes, the Akashic Record is a cultural interpretation of the idea that non-local consciousness is that we are dealing with an information phenomenon. Mm-hmm. That all of the information that ever was is available.
Yeah.
And we know that people can describe things down to tiny little details. You know, the Brig Leander, we were looking for this ship, the Brig Leander, and people were describing these little bitty glass ball, a little glass vials with powdered medicine in them, which we found. Now, they were doing this from Rome, from Sydney, Australia, just giving me the remote viewing data and describing these little tiny things, which we later discovered exactly where they put them. So how do they do that? Where is that information?
Yeah.
So right?
The answer is it's in the non-local domain, in certain religions they call the Akashic Record, but that's what it is.
So it's almost kind of like the brain is limited, non-local consciousness isn't. It's almost kind of like non-local consciousness is the cloud, and we have like a limited hard drive, a limited, you know, gigabyte hard drive that we're able to. Now, what I'd like to ask you,
tell us
what I would like to ask you is, do you feel in our human, you know, in our vessel here, in our, you know, maybe, you know, I've listened to and read some things about how like consciousness maybe doesn't necessarily have to reside in the head, you know, like, are there other parts of the body that you feel like someone will maybe feel something in their chest or in their heart or in their, you know, where does their consciousness draw from?
Well, it's, again, you want to think about consciousness not as a place, but as a information reality. Maybe that's the way to describe it. I mean, increasing research is showing that there is something that part of your consciousness is in your gut, part of it is in your heart, that the neurosciences are beginning to describe how certain feelings and reactions and controls in the body are lodged, as I say, in the gut or in the heart. But I think a better, clearer way to think about it is that you are a creation of consciousness. I mean, the research suggests to us, the reincarnation research, for instance, suggests very strongly that you pick your parents, you pick your socioeconomic group, you pick your race. You, all of that is designed to give you a set of circumstances that will allow you to make choices that will create information patterns.
Wow.
And so you literally control your genetics. You choose your parents, you choose your genetic formation. We know, for instance, again, from the research that in meditation, you can alter the structure of the telomeres, the part of the DNA that it can be altered by meditation. We know, for instance, that individuals come across between lives with scar tissue or birthmarks from places where they experienced wounds that killed them, or where people mark them as they're dying. They create some kind of mark, and then when they're born, again, they bear. Wow. They have a birthmark or a scar tissue or some kind of marking at that exact location. Again, what we're dealing with is the continuity of consciousness, that consciousness exists prior to birth, during life, and continues after physical death. There is an aspect of you, the eternal self, what religion calls the soul, and that all of this consciousness is interlinked and interdependent. And the importance of that is that we have reached a point in our culture, in our societies, that developed as a result of a view of reality in which the earth is seen as a kind of exploitable bank account. That we are separate from, we have dominion over it and are separate from it. And in fact, the reality is that we are part of the matrix of consciousness, and that all consciousness is interlinked and interdependent. And that once you recognize that, you develop different kinds of technologies than when your view is the earth is just an exploitable bank account.
Absolutely.
Well, you can't have enemies anymore.
Yeah.
Because then you're just hurting yourself.
Well, and also, you have those moments where even if it's you're geographically in a place where, say, you're at the top of a, 13 or 14,000 foot peak, and you look out and you're like, I'm tiny. This place is massive. And you have that new technology that's like, oh boy, yeah, I'm a piece of a larger thing instead of, when you're in traffic and you're beeping the horn at the person in front of you. Yeah. I'm totally on board with that.
Once you realize that consciousness is causal and fundamental, your whole view of the world changes, because then you don't see, for instance, I just read an article this morning about how the fisheries are collapsing because of overfishing, because they don't really conceive of the fish as in any way really connected with them. They're just exploitable assets that you can use. Yeah. And we are destroying the fisheries because we overfish. Well, once you begin to see consciousness as causal and fundamental, and that you are part of the matrix of consciousness, you stop doing things like that.
Right.
You don't use carbon energy.
You stop fracking.
Yes. You treat people equally. You don't.
Yeah.
Race is not an appropriate issue. Gender is not an appropriate issue to be prejudiced against something, because we are all part of this network of life. And once you get that, you realize that, oh, I'm part of this. And not only am I affecting them, they're affecting me. And also, and this is very important. If you look at creative geniuses, whether they are in the arts or in the sciences, what you discover is that the source of their creative genius, as they will tell you, is that they open to non-local consciousness. Yeah. Tesla says he's walking across Central Park and he has a vision of the electric motor. And he goes back to his lab and he says to his engineers, I want you to make this for me, not prototype it, just make this. They make it for him. He turns it on. It's an electric motor.
Yeah.
Poincaré yeah. says, one of the great mathematicians of history, I'm walking across the road and I have a vision of my mathematics. Descartes says, I have three dreams in Germany in 1619 that reveal this mathematics that I'm famous for. Einstein says, I saw the theories of relativity as I was whiling away an afternoon in a canoe after I had been sick. Brahms, Beethoven, Mozart say they heard the music. They were in an altered state of consciousness, and they heard the music and just wrote it down.
It's amazing.
So this idea that opening to non-local consciousness is a critical component of creative genius. When you look at people who are creative, acknowledged by history to be creative geniuses, over and over again, they will tell you, I had this experience. It's a non-local consciousness experience. I was walking across with Jonas Salk at the Salk Institute, and I said, where did you get the idea for the vaccine? He said, oh, I saw it in a dream.
Yeah. The conduit.
Science.
The conduit.
Yeah. Everybody thinks it's so separate from
that's beautiful.
The spiritual realm, and it's not. Can you talk? I know we usually only do about an hour, and I don't want to keep you. We really appreciate your time.
Of course.
But there's one thing I want to ask you about that I want our fans to hear. You were talking about some more of these experiments that were done, and I think it was someone, I don't know if it was a particular religion, but it was basically a sick person laying on of hands. They were healed, but you also put a vial of water in the patient's hand.
No, not the patient. I wondered, why is water so much a part of sacred experiences? Mm. Why? How about Coca-Cola?
Well, we're mostly water, our bodies. The planet's mostly water.
Yeah, that's the sort of obvious. But I thought, why is it? Does something happen to water when it is exposed to therapeutic intention? Mm. You know, the priest comes in and blesses the water. It's now holy water. You're going to get baptized, or you're going to get submerged, or you're whatever the ceremony is. So in order to test that, I had people do healings while they had little vials of very, very pure water in little glass bottles. And they were held in a little cloth tube on the palm of their hand. And they did whatever kind of healing they wanted. You know, everything from channeling space people to evangelical Christian healing to
Reiki. Did you do Reiki?
You know, whatever. It didn't make any difference. You see, all what happens is cultures develop culturally appropriate ways of expressing these aspects of consciousness. But the technique is a cultural affectation or a cultural creation. It's really dealing with something more fundamental that is. And so different cultures develop different ways of doing it, but it's all the same thing when you get down to the short part.
That's so what I always say.
I had people doing these healings, and then I used infrared spectrophotometry to do an analysis of the water compared to control samples that had exactly the same history except for being exposed to the healing part. And what we discovered was that there was a very specific change in the molecular structure of the water that was exposed to healing. And that that correlated also with whether the patient, the recipient of the therapeutic intention, had a healing experience.
Wow. Also, if they weren't healed, then the water didn't show the change. So the patient has to be in alignment to accept it? Or?
No, I don't know that the patient needs to be in alignment, although I think there is a kind of linkage, a deal between the healer and the recipient. No, I mean, some of the people who were recipients, you know, basically they were just lying on a table, a massage table, while the healer was working. We filmed it. And we had a 5-minute bottle, a 10-minute bottle of water, a 15-minute bottle of water. Mm. What we thought we would see was that the longer the exposure, the greater the change. That was not true. It didn't matter whether it was the 5-minute, the 10-minute, or the 15-minute bottle, which suggests that time in the healing is not the key. The key is the linkage.
The intention.
And that it occurred, but these changes in the water, in the molecular structure of the bottle, water, in having to do with the HO bonding relationship, how, you know, one atom of one molecule of water and links with another and another and another, those linkages altered when they were exposed to the healing intention.
Wow.
That's deep. But then the other thing you extrapolated from this is heavy, because my mother did this. Sorry, Mom, if I'm outing you right now, but that it can also go the other way, that it's not, it can be hurtful. So that the same principle applies to, like, you hear these tales of slaves, like if somebody was treating them bad, they would run a voodoo thing on them and the person would get sick. And it'd be like, if you stop it, you know, and it's like, so you can also curse as well as bless.
Yes, it goes. It can be negative. One of the very early, going all the way back, a guy named Barry in France in 1968 was looking at going both ways. That is, he could take bacteria and could you, or fungus, and could you make it do better or make it do worse? And he discovered people could do both.
Wow.
So, and that's where the idea of the voodoo negative eye or the curse or the evil eye, or all, you know, depending again which culture you're talking about, the same idea that negative intention also has a negative effect, positive intention has a positive effect.
Wow. It's like what Star Wars is talking about, the Force. You have Vader and you have Luke, you know? So my mom told us that somebody was doing something very bad, and my dad and my uncle wanted to do something very bad to this person. And my mom said, no, there's another way. And she told me the next day when I found out about this, she said, if someone ever does something, you know, really heinous to you, never take retribution. You picture them clearly, and then you picture a fog coming up behind them, and then you can't see them anymore until all you can see is fog. And that person died within 6 months of cancer. And I was like, now my dad, who doesn't believe in anything mystical, I said, well, what about Mom? He goes, well, I know people shouldn't mess around with your mother. I was like, man, you don't get to have it both ways, dude. Like, no.
Your mother sounds like a very insightful woman.
She quit doing stuff. There was a certain point I remember. I wish I could remember which age it was. But some things happened. And, you know, there's a tab to pay for whatever you do. I happen to think she got in alignment with this person's bad karma, and that she just kind of fanned the flames and then took them on out. But yeah, and she probably was doing this with some other people too. But yeah, she stopped. But she's a super psychic, super. Mm-hmm. My sister, like, all, and it's all about this intention. As you say, that's the whole thing, you know.
Yeah, we know, for instance, Roger Nelson, who has the Global Consciousness Project, also somebody you should interview. Roger has shown that where there is a coherence of intentioned awareness, Princess Diana's death, a tsunami in Japan, Chernobyl, that sort of thing, where there is something that draws the collective awareness of large numbers of people, there is a coalescence of intentioned awareness that random number generators that he's got scattered all over the world, they go non-random. And so we literally are creating reality with consciousness, and it is the result of a collective consciousness and also multi-generational.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
Wow. I know that from like stuff that I'm having to heal in my life that, you know, goes to my dad, his dad, my mom's dad. There, it just keeps going back. And I just woke up and inherited a lot of this shit. But fortunately, they've helped me sort it out and unpack it and try to throw away what, you know, break what religious people were called generational curses. You know? Yes. I'm like, it's just all semantics. We're getting hung up on so many semantics. And I'm like, man, like you said before, like all these religions are basically protocols. They're like scientific protocols, and that's they continue exactly to correct. Work. That's why they work throughout the generations. And it's just semantics saying, oh, that this is wrong and that one's right. It's like, they're all,
that is a very good, religions are protocols to open to non-local consciousness.
Mm-hmm. In various ways. And I want to know all of them and the non-religious ones.
Oh, yes.
Because it's like the buffet. I want to have every type of chicken that every person on the planet, you know what? I want peanut butter chicken from Ghana. I want curry chicken from Jamaica and from India and from Thailand. You know?
Well, you know, I mean, to that illusion, that analogy you're making, no matter how you cook it, it's still chicken.
It's still chicken. It's intention. Yeah, I was going to be, our daughter's name was Kavanaugh, which I mispronounced for years, Kavanaugh. I got it from an Abraham Joshua Heschel book. And he talked about, it's a Hebrew word that means intention. It struck me so hard. He was talking about the reason we can't judge another person is because we don't have enough information. Only God has enough information to judge their intention and their history. And it just hit me like an arrow. If she's from India, we started calling her Kavi just as for short. And turns out that's an Indian name that means poetess or songstress. So we ended up giving her the Indian name. But that's where it originally was. It was Kavanaugh, which I think is that it's the linchpin for me, you know. So when I when I found your videos with Mishlove, I was like, man, this is the dude. Because I wanted it coming from the non-religious point. Like, I'm not, I would be a heretic of any religion. Christianity, probably. Yeah. Christian heretic is probably what you would
call
it.
Me too.
Right. But I love that when you said, I'm data, man. I'm all about data. I was like, but you're saying the same thing where I was coming from. And so it's such a relief to meet you, man.
You know, meditation, you can do a completely non-religious, in fact, I teach a form of meditation which is entirely based on the research. But if you think about it, what you have in religions are empirical sciences that developed over hundreds or thousands of years because people observed that if you do this, that happens.
Yeah. It works. Be still and know that I'm God.
Empirical sciences, they're protocols developed by observational empirical science.
Yeah, that's what and that's how I look at it. I hope they get rejoined because, you know, the first time I ever, when I tried to meditate, it wasn't from learning from someone else, which is my first mistake. And so, you know, I couldn't quiet the monkey mind, and which you learn that that's something that everybody goes through. The first time I successfully meditated was in a very long prayer. I was praying and then it went on and then I was somewhere else and then a long period of time passed and it felt like a very short period of time. And when I came out and I noticed what the time was, I was like, that's the first time I ever meditated. But it started with prayer. So you see it in the Bible. It's be still and know that I am God. Mm-hmm. Or they went off to the mountain to pray. They were going off to meditate and just commune with this consciousness, the Holy Spirit, whatever the semantics you want to call it. Right? Yeah. I can see it. I was like,
what you realize when you get through the dogmas and the scriptures, this is all the same stuff. It just develops differently in different cultures because it speaks to certain cultural parameters. But when you get down to it, it's all chicken.
That's right.
I look at it as a diamond with it's as many facets mm-hmm. as there are spirits or humans.
Yeah.
And each facet of it. And so it's the whole, it's the totality of it. So this isn't wrong. You turn it this way and the light comes through. You turn it this way. It's like, we need all of it. I need all of it. Even the negative somehow, which is a real hard thing to swallow. You know, that's a tough one. But how you have spring without winter? Sorry, everything's got to die and freeze. It sucks. But that you got to take it, you know?
Yes.
Well, thank you, man. So I would love to have you on for two more hours, but I got to go help my wife with the kids. And I really appreciate you giving us so much of your time.
My pleasure, guys.
Bless you, man.
Wish you well. Would you please let me know when you put it up so that we'll put the URL on my websites?
Oh, yes. And thank you for that.
My pleasure.
And I'll be reaching out to try to see how my remote viewing works.
Okay.
I meditate every day for the past decade, so I'm excited to try it.
I'd like to do that too.
Thank you so much, and we'll let you know. Thanks everyone for listening. See you next time.
All right, you take care. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye, sir.
Bye-bye.
Osiris.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.